Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with New Orleans historian Eberhard Lowe Faber, author of Building the Land of Dreams, New Orleans and the Transformation of Early America. We'll also talk with prize-winning British military historian Anthony Beaver, author of Ardennes 1944, The Battle of the Bulge. Eberhard Faber, called Lowe, teaches history and music industry studies at Loyola University here in New Orleans. Before that, he was the leader of the rock band God Street Wine for 12 years, and they still play together occasionally. His first book takes us back to the early days of our city and is called Building the Land of Dreams, New Orleans and the Transformation of Early America. Well, Lowe Faber, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you have the best name for a writer ever. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about your name and your family business.
Yeah, sure. First of all, I've always been Lowe Faber to everyone who knows me. I only decided to use Eberhard, which is my full name, as my author name. In my music career, I was always Lowe. And even
sense.
In my teaching career before the book was published, my students call me Dr. Lowe.
Dr. Lowe, I like it.
But Eberhard Faber is a German name, and my ancestors were Germans. And one of them, named Eberhard Faber, came over to New York in 1849 to sell pencils for the German pencil company. And instead of selling pencils for the German company, he decided to go out on his own instead and start an American company called Eberhard Faber. And he was briefly in business with Henry David Thoreau.
Wow.
Their first pencil-making operation was on the present site of the United Nations on the East River.
Wow. And you worked in the family business for a while.
I graduated from high school and I went to work for the family business. And I worked in the shipping floor and I worked in the factory and then I worked on the road with the sales force all at 18 years old, right out of high school. And the experience of that was that I was so unhappy doing it that I fled from it into college and music instead.
Well, there you go. Powerful motivation.
And then we sold the business a year after that.
But still, I can imagine all these people looking at this book and going, Eberhard Faber, that sounds so familiar, you
That's
know?
Right.
And then college, and you went on to rock and roll for 12 years.
I dropped out of college to tour with a rock band. I tell my
Everybody's
students,
dream.
Don't follow this career path, yeah. But it was the right thing for me. Mm-hmm. And I did God Street Wine for 12 years. And then I did my own band for about 3 years after that. And then when my daughter was born, I decided I'd had enough of buses and vans and Motel 6s and rank-smelling backstage rooms. And I decided to go back and finish college at this little liberal arts college in upstate New York, Skidmore College, and actually got my bachelor's degree on my 40th birthday.
Wow. And then we went on to Princeton for graduate school.
Princeton for grad school, which is also where I'm from and where my wife is from. So we were townies in Princeton growing up and moved home for me to do my PhD.
So what drew you to New Orleans history for research?
It's an obvious question, and I have never had a good answer to it because I've never had a personal connection to New Orleans.
Wow.
It was purely my intellectual interests in early America and American expansion. How this collection of seaboard towns at the time of the Revolution became a continental nation. Mm-hmm. And I started to think that New Orleans was a really key hinge in that process. And of course, that's part of what the book is about.
Well, I love what you said about quoting an historian who says, you know, New Orleans history is like the gift that keeps on giving.
Larry Powell.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I thought it might be. Now, what astonishes me about this book, it's so interesting, it's the way you describe all these kind of swirling energies of the period and the sense of a city struggling to find its identity. You know, is New Orleans French? Is New Orleans Spanish? Is New Orleans American? And there's this kind of push me, pull you going on all the time between different cultural influences.
Yeah, and I think even those national boxes are not
They're too narrow enough
because, for example, there's a huge rivalry between Louisiana Creoles, meaning people born in the New World, and what historians call the foreign French, immigrants from France, of whom there were many after the purchase. There's actually a big influx of new arrivals from France. And these people from France, like Losat himself and this man that I talk about in the conclusion, Jean Bose, they're born in France and they really are prejudiced against Louisiana Creoles. They consider these people to have sort of descended to a lower level of humanity by spending too much time in the New
in
World.
The swamp land.
Or maybe too much time around Africans. That was part of it, too. And you know, to lump them all together as French is very wrong because that was a huge divide between them. And there are big divides between Americans, and Americans from different regions are very divided amongst themselves. And so, yeah, it's not just the national groups. It's race and it's class and it's different cultures and it's different ideologies. Even if you happened to be of the from the same race and region, you might just have very different political ideas, because this is an era of great political upheaval and revolutions.
And one of the things you point out is that some of the changes in this period are so rapid, but others are so gradual. And it's interesting the way you distinguish those things.
I'm curious what you think. What was rapid and what was gradual for you?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of the way, you know, somebody could fire the cabildo and then all of a sudden there would be no government.
Yeah,
know?
Well, right. That good point. Losat was disappointed that he had come to Louisiana to be prefect, and he had all these kind of grandiose notions of reforms that he was going to make. And then he gets the news that it's been sold to the Americans, and he didn't like the Americans, so he's really upset about it. So he ends up in power for 20 days, which was just an accident, really. But during those 20 days, he took it upon himself to dissolve the Cabildo, which had been the municipal government of New Orleans for 40 years, and replace it with this system that no one really understood. So when the Americans came in, there was no system in place.
But that's the other great underlying theme that keeps coming up in this book, is how difficult it is to set up these systems for a city. You know, a governing body, a legal system, the courts.
Right.
Yeah,
they had to invent
difficult.
Everything from scratch. There's actually quite a bit of scholarship on the legal system question. And, you know, many better legal historians than I have written a lot about this. There's a wonderful book from the 70s by George Dargo called Jefferson's Louisiana about the politics of the common law versus civil law struggle. But, you know, what I talk about in the book is how that struggle happened simultaneously with struggles over the racial order and slavery and the idea of democracy, and how all these things were intertwined.
And one of the other things, it seems to me, that was playing out was that when you're building a city, you need authority, but at the same time, you fear it. And you want to be sure you establish it within reasonable limits.
It's all about what you want to do with the authority, right? So in 1805... the Americans had actually put in an American-style municipal government, which meant a municipal corporation.
Right.
You know, business corporations weren't the first corporations. Towns were the first corporations. And so New Orleans became, in effect, an independent corporation. And then an all-Louisiana Creole city government took over. And now they have this power and legitimacy that they've never had before. So what did they do? They created this police force called the Gendarmerie, which was a mounted police force with these very elaborate uniforms. And basically, it was a slave patrol. It was designed to get runaway slaves back to where they were supposed to be and to keep people of color, whether they were free or enslaved, off the streets. Yeah. And so it shows you exactly what they thought the priority was for New Orleans. So that was what the Creole elite thought needed to happen. But then the Gendarmerie became very controversial because it was heavy-handed and it was too much policing and it was incredibly expensive and the uniforms were over the top. And so then the whole thing fell apart after 8 months.
That's rapid change.
Yeah.
But one of the other things that's kind of stayed with me in this book is how many of the ideas that we have about the city where we live have been there from the very beginning. Just the notion of New Orleans as a land of dreams.
Yeah. A wonderful recent book about this is Shannon Doughty's book, yes, Building the Devil's Empire, where she writes really beautifully about how in European eyes that New Orleans is this site of sort of decadence and transgression that has always been there. And for Yankees, too, you know, many of the people coming down from New York and Pennsylvania, a lot of them came very apprehensive about the morals of this place. But I think building the land of dreams, the land of dreams comes from two places. One is the Spencer Williams song that New Orleanians are familiar with from Louis Armstrong's version of it, you know, Basin Street Blues.
Yeah.
The place where dark and light folks meet, mm-hmm, on the banks of the Mississippi. But the other, which to me is just as important, is William Blake's poem from the late 1790s, I think, The Land of Dreams. And Blake was, you know, a sort of visionary of this age of revolutions when, you know, the American and French and Haitian and Latin American revolutions were all happening in this time period. And I think it was a period where the possibilities for the whole human race expanded. And the idea of a land of dreams, and it's, you know, human possibilities could be imagined that just weren't a century before. And New Orleans, the culture that eventually developed in New Orleans, I think is a great instance of that, how it came out of this.
Well, there's a lot of food for thought here. We've been talking with Lo Faber, whose fascinating new book is Building the Land of Dreams, New Orleans and the Transformation of Early America. You can meet him Wednesday, November 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. Lo, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
British historian Anthony Beaver completes his four-volume history of important battles in World War II with his most recent book, Ardennes, 1944, The Battle of the Bulge. Beaver is the author of 10 best-selling and prize-winning histories, including D-Day, The Battle for Normandy, The Battle for Spain, The Fall of Berlin, 1945, and The Second World War. Anthony Beaver, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much.
You've said that your interest in military history came from your own military background, studying at Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy, and then your own military service. But that doesn't always translate to writing. So how did you develop your writing chops?
Well, with the innocence and arrogance of youth, I thought I could be a writer because all of my mother's side of the family had all been writers. And somehow it seemed to work, but I really owed it much more to a particular editor, Jane Hill, who was with one of the great publishers in London. And she was my editor, and I would come out afterwards feeling rather humiliated by everything she told me, but I learnt more from her than I could possibly have learnt from any writing, creative writing course or anything like that. And so gradually one started to write in a slightly different way and actually enjoying the process of writing.
Ah, that's great. Nobody ever talks about humiliation as a rite of passage in the writing life.
Oh, it's a very important
thing
to go
is.
Through.
Now, I also thought it was interesting that this book, Ardennes 1944, was published with the subtitle Hitler's Last Gamble in the United Kingdom. And here it's simply The Battle of the Bulge. What made for the change?
Well, for the Americans, the battle was always the Battle of the Bulge. But in fact, that was a word which came in. It was invented by journalists, but it seems to have caught on that much more in the United States. We always tend to think of it much more as the Ardennes, and so do the Germans. I mean, they refer to it as the Ardennes Offensive, the Ardennes Offensive. Mm-hmm. So there's always going to be a sort of slight difference in that particular way. But it was obvious from the point of view of the American publishers that they just had to have that word, the bulge, in.
And
I could hardly resist.
Now, one of the things that makes this book so fascinating to me is how you incorporate so many cultural figures into your work. Ernest Hemingway, J.D. Salinger, Kurt Vonnegut, the poet Louis Simpson, whom I love and whom you quote so often, Martha Gellhorn, Marlene Dietrich. So talk about, you know, what of their work spoke to you?
Well, I think that Martha Gellhorn, who wrote a superb novel, about this particular period, much better than anything that Hemingway wrote in Across the River and In the Through the Trees. But the fact is they were there also showed this astonishing cross-section of American society in the U.S. Army at that particular time. Right. The fact that you should have Salinger, you know, writing part of Catcher in the Rye during the fighting in the Hurkin Forest, only just a few hundred yards or maybe a mile or so away from where Hemingway was, you know, with Buck Lanham's 22nd Infantry. It says a lot about sort of, you know, as I say, the very broad cross-section of American society at that particular time. And Kurt Vonnegut, with his experiences in the Bulge when he was cut off with part of the 106th Infantry Division, and as a result suffered like so many other American soldiers captured at that particular point, and then going through the firestorm of Dresden with Slaughterhouse-5, it's an essential part of history as well as just the cultural side.
And to be able to quote such exquisite poetry is fairly irresistible to a writer, I would think. And then, of course, there's Patton's poetry, which is not so irresistible.
Well, if you can call it poetry,
yes.
I think one would almost call it doggerel. But
yes.
Anyway, the very fact that Patton considered himself capable of writing poetry, I think, is quite significant in itself.
I think he considered himself capable of anything, really. You said that it's the humanity displayed in wartime that really interests you. And you spend considerable time in this book talking about the humanity of generals and military leaders. And some of the most well-known, of course, are Field Marshal Montgomery, who apparently irritated everybody. Omar Bradley, who was quite sickly, it seems, and of course, Eisenhower. So did you have a sense that you were going beyond a lot of conventional portraits to flesh out the way we think about these men?
Well, I was fascinated simply by the material one finds in the archives. I mean, the diaries of Chester Hansen, who was with Bradley the whole time and sort of his personal aide, who's actually recording almost like sort of Eckermann's conversations with Goethe. I mean, you know, he's almost sort of recording everything that Bradley says and reacts to and so forth. And this is sort of such a valuable insight into high command in war. And particularly Bradley's paranoia, he felt that sort of he'd been personally humiliated partly by the fact that he'd been caught out by the surprise German attack on the 16th of December. But then to hear that Eisenhower was giving command of the Northern Front to Montgomery, purely because Bradley couldn't physically, from where he was down in the south in Luxembourg, control it. And he took this all terribly seriously and personally. But the real sort of hatred which he felt was, for Field Marshal Montgomery. And Montgomery was responsible for that. I mean, Montgomery behaved abominably. But I think, and I suggest, that actually Montgomery had high-functioning Asperger's, and mm-hmm. this has been supported now by others in various sources and so forth. And I think it's the best explanation for why he behaved in the extraordinary way that he did. He was egged on, I'm afraid, badly by the British press, who refused to acknowledge that, you know, Britain's contribution to the war was diminishing day by day, while obviously the American contribution was increasing, paying for actually for the whole thing with American gasoline, American tanks, and all the rest of it. And there was no question of the Americans ever accepting Montgomery as the ground forces commander, as the British press and Montgomery wanted. And Montgomery, in fact, just put up everybody's backs in that particular way. But that didn't mean that he was an idiot. In fact, I think that actually Montgomery's handling of the battle in the North was probably more sensible than that of the American generals, who wanted to wipe out the humiliation that they had experienced of being caught out by this surprise attack and wanted to sort of crush the German bulge in the most conspicuous way. But that actually would have led to terrible casualties because, as Montgomery realized, you know, attacking over open snowfields with men wading through the snow sort of up to their thighs was the way, I'm afraid, to cause huge casualties. And that was one of the reasons why Montgomery was sort of fairly deliberate and slow in launching the counterattack. Mm-hmm. But that didn't mean he got everything right, far from it. I mean, one sees, even with Patton, who did brilliantly at the start in the way that he remaneuvered the whole of his Third Army to counterattack from the south. But Patton, in his diaries, acknowledges that actually his impatience led to many, many casualties amongst his own troops.
Now, beyond these well-known figures, you describe with such compassion the terrible experiences of the ordinary men, the infantry, the artillery. You talk about the panic and the desperate need for release. And I love that fine distinction you make between replacements and reinforcements. And how young these men were.
Well, they were even younger on the German side. I mean, there they had 15-year-olds, fighting, who'd been forced into uniform and were fighting. But you're right. I mean, the 18-year-olds coming from across the Atlantic, never been in Europe before. I mean, many of those in the 106th Infantry Division, like Kurt Vonnegut's comrades, were surrounded, cut off, and suffered appallingly in the prison camps afterwards. Many of them simply died out of sort of sheer depression and exhaustion and so forth. No, all of them were in a very, very vulnerable state. There's no doubt about it. And I'm afraid the replacement system, the British Army was no better, let me quickly add. But the lack of imagination in the whole of the replacement system really was pretty chilling.
Another thing that really interested me is that the landscape itself during this battle seemed to be the enemy. The forest, the mud, the difficulty in making inroads. It's almost as if that's another war in itself.
It was, and one has to, I think, know that terrain, that topography, to understand it. I mean, there was something really sinister about those deep pine forests where men were fighting, and particularly the Hütgen Forest just before the Ardennes, where, you know, men were literally going crazy, and it wasn't surprising. You've only got to go inside those forests to sort of see how, feel how sinister they were, as if in some sort of cursed fairy tale. But above all, the weather. I mean, you know, when the Russian Highs, it was called, which was this very still freezing weather which arrived from the east on the 23rd of December, and temperatures suddenly dropped down to minus 23, 24, 25 degrees centigrade. They were facing something which was certainly beyond any of our experiences, because they were out there in many cases without even overcoats. The American army, I'm afraid, had felt, well, you know, the war is over, and they simply hadn't done enough to bring in the sort of winter uniform which was needed. And in fact, they didn't have any camouflage, and that's why you had village mayors sounding the church bell and begging the population to hand over their precious linen sheets so that, you know, U.S. troops could turn them into camouflage, rip them up and cover their helmets or wrap around their machine gun barrels, because the Germans were prepared with, you know, reversible uniforms which have white on the inside.
Mm. Now, your wonderful book trailer shows you in the snow in the Ardennes yourself. How important has it been for you to actually set foot in these places that you write about?
Well, I think you always need to if you can. I mean, what one's got to be careful about is you can sometimes go back to a battlefield in the past and find that sort of, you know, it's become an industrial estate or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be worse than useless, because it'll destroy any imagination you might have. But in areas like the Ardennes, where very little has changed, and you can actually see the ground and as it was at the time, and actually you can see the trees where, for example, you know, the landowners can't even sell the trees for timber because the shrapnel is still so deep inside them. You do need to try to see what it was like at the time, to appreciate what the people were going through at the time. And not just the soldiers, but also the Belgian civilians and how they suffered.
I know, that story of the shrapnel in the trees really struck home to me. That was fascinating. Now, you've said that this finishes World War II for you and that you'll follow this book with a big biography of Napoleon. So how does that make you feel to have finished years and years of devotion to this subject? Are you relieved? Are you sad? Or?
Well, I don't want to sound like, you know, Frank Sinatra on a comeback, but I have to admit that, in fact, there is going to be another book on the next level. No, what happened was, funny enough, it was in the writing of this book, there was about a chapter and a half on Operation Market Garden, you know, the 82nd and 101st Airborne dropping into Holland and the British 1st Airborne dropping on Arnhem. And I put in a chapter and a half on that to sort of lean up. And then on reflection, I realized that this actually was not doing it justice as a story, but also it was a terrible waste of an incredible story. Again, something which, my God, we got wrong. And people suffered for it, particularly in this case, the Dutch civilians. So I discussed it with my publishers, and they all said, yes, yes, yes. And in fact, to my horror, but also relief, they did say that they were very glad that I was dropping the idea of doing the biography of Napoleon. It's strange how these things turn out.
We've been talking with award-winning British military historian Anthony Beaver, whose new book is Ardennes 1944, The Battle of the Bulge. You can meet him when he visits the National World War II Museum for the International Conference on World War II 1945, The Bitter End. Mr. Beaver speaks Friday, November 20th at 8 and Saturday, November 21st at 11:30. Visit ww2conference.com for complete details and registration. Anthony, thank you so much.
It was great being with you. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper columnist Leonard Pitts discusses his new novel, Grant Park, Tuesday, November 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Chef Amanda Freitag signs The Chef Next Door, a pro chef's recipes for fun, fearless home cooking, Tuesday, November 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Elise Arden celebrates the re-release of her first novel, The Casket Girls, Tuesday, November 17th at 7 at the Boutique du Vampire, 709 First Street. Today's guest, Eberhard Lowe Faber, discusses and signs Building the Land of Dreams, New Orleans and the Transformation of Early America, Wednesday, November 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. Room 220 presents Alex Marr, author of Witches of America, Margaret Eby, author of South Toward Home, Travels in Southern Literature, and Justin Noble, author of All the Magic I Had Hoped For, reading their work Wednesday, November 18th at 7 at the Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Sybil Heidel Morial discusses and signs Witness to Change, From Jim Crow to Political Empowerment, Wednesday, November 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Tanwi Nandini Islam signs her debut novel, Bright Lines, Thursday, November 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Scott Deechy signs Cocktail Noir, From Gangsters and Gin Joints to Gumshoes and Gimlets, Thursday, November 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Dogfish Reading Series presents a handmade book showcase featuring Joseph Makos and his students, Thursday, November 19th at 7 at 2448 North Fillory. Deborah Deason signs her children's book, Not Very Merry Pout Pout Fish, Friday, November 20th at 4 at Octavia Books. Cheryl Gerber signs New Orleans, Life and Death in the Big Easy, Friday, November 20th at 5 at Kitchen Witch Cookbooks, 1422 North Broad, Suite C. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Illusion of Separateness by Simon Van Bowie, Saturday, November 21st at 10:30 at Octavia Books. New members are welcome. Nicholas Meese discusses and signs New Orleans Hurricanes from the Start, Saturday, November 21st at 2 at the Historic New Orleans Collections Williams Research Center. Kelly and Chip Malthrop read and sign their children's book, The ABC Animal Hospital, Saturday, November 21st at 2 at Octavia Books. Musician and author Zachary Richard reads from and signs his children's book, The Legend of Little Red, Sunday, November 22nd at 1 at Octavia Books. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, November 22nd at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Gloria Steinem signs My Life on the Road, Sunday, November 22nd at 3 at Octavia Books. Russell Scott Anderson, writing as Russell Scott, signs his new novel, The Hard Times, Monday, November 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Judy Bottoni and Peggy Scott Labor discuss and sign New Orleans Mardi Gras Moments, Tuesday, November 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library have moved their book sale to the Algiers Regional Branch, 3014 Holiday Boulevard. The sale is now open 4 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday from 10 to 2. And the big event this week is the National World War II Museum's International Conference on World War II, 1945, The Bitter End. For more information, check out www.2conference.com for complete details and registration. Today's guest, award-winning British military historian Anthony Beaver, whose new book is Ardennes 1944, The Battle of the Bulge, appears Friday, November 20th at 8 and Saturday, November 21st at 11:30. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.